call this meeting of the House Health and Human Services Committee to order, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order temporarily for the purpose of having, where am I? Oh, there it is. Never mind. You've written all over my thing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3153 to allow Dr. Skolnick to give his testimony because I know he's got other places to be. Please come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to apologize to the vice chairs, both Representative Dalton and Representative Tomei. The testimony that I submitted in writing, unfortunately, had the vice chairs from last session. So my apologies for making that error.
Doctor, we'll need your name for the record, please.
Lawrence L. Skolnick, PhD. And if you... committee will allow me, I'll read the testimony. Honorable Chairman Jeff Cruz and Vice Chairman Representative Dalton and Representative Tomei, members of the committee. My purpose in appearing before you today is to express the need for licensing of hypnotherapists in Oregon. At this time, I would like to advise the committee that the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association has retained the services of a grant writer and established a fund to cover the cost of licensing board in order to eliminate or minimize the cost of such a board from the state of Oregon. First of all, let me talk about what hypnotherapy is. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines hypnotherapy is psychotherapy that facilitates suggestion, re-education, or analysis by means of a natural state of deep physical and mental relaxation. But at this time, let me tell you that all of hypnosis is self-hypnosis. There is not any other kind. All I or any qualified individual can do is act as a teacher or a guide to help someone reach that deep state of relaxation that I call a place of tranquility. This is a place which enables the subconscious mind to take a more active role in helping to modify habit or change personality traits. We use self-hypnosis to program the mind many times in life. For example, most of us drive a car. When we first learned to process, it was basically to follow instructions. For me, that was a long time ago. It was, one, adjust the seat comfortably, two, adjust the rearview mirror, three, put the key ignition, there were no seat belts then, put gear shift in neutral, step on a clutch before starting the engine, and check traffic before pulling away from the curb. Of course, today, a lot of steps have been eliminated by automatic drive and safety belts, etc. However, no matter how we were trained, our subconscious does that for us automatically. The conscious keeps us safe, but we now don't think of each step as we have used self-hypnosis to program ourselves for this process. A qualified hypnotherapist will not take on a patient unless the following criteria are met. One, the subject has a sincere desire to change. Two, and the reason for change is valid. The individual shows the ability to harness the imagination well, such as a test or tests we can give. Let me give you an example of what I mean. The client was referred to me by her physician to stop smoking. When I asked her why she wanted to become a non-smoker, she replied, that her doctor told her she had to. I then said to her, I'm aware of that, but why do you want to become a non-smoker? She replied, I don't really want to, but he said I had to. I did not take her on because I felt it would be taking money, knowing her motivation would not be successful, and reported to the doctor as such. He later informed me that the patient went to another hypnotherapist and told the doctor, well, it didn't work. As a hypnotherapist, I knew it would not help her due to the non-desire for change. By requiring hypnotherapists to be licensed, the public would be protected from being tested and treated by someone who is not qualified. There are many wonderful success stories, ranging from medical doctors like Bernie Siegel, MD, in his book Love, Medicine, and Miracles. He reports to the manager clinic on the success using of hypnosis. In my own practice, I would like to share with you a couple of highlights. A client that was suffering from anxiety due to an up-and-coming kidney transplant, as his father was a donor, and he was fearful of the results. By treating him, we were able to not only eliminate his fears and aid him to look forward to the experience, but later was advised by the surgeon that his relaxed state enabled him to control the flow of blood, thereby eliminating the need for extra blood during surgery. A local woman who suffered low self-esteem, within three sessions, was able to change her attitude about herself, so much so that her fellow workers noticed a difference in her, as well as the way she groomed herself, feeling much more secure. Channel 2 News reported of a client of mine that was allergic to anesthetic but needed to have a root canal. The video of that root canal is available should any of the committee members wish to view it. In addition, we have done several other extensive dental work with local Salem dentists. There now exists in our state many out-of-state individuals who will certify hypnotherapists with a weekend of training to allow anyone to call themselves a certified hypnotherapist. Licensing would eliminate that weekend wonders. This bill proposes a licensing board made up of 5 members, 3 of whom are members of the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association, which requires for membership a minimum of 150 hours of clinical training, which, among other subjects, teaches a curriculum of techniques of client assessment, contraindications for hypnosis, law and ethics, suggestibility testing, administration and record keeping, just to name a few. The above being a minimum, which of course does not include technical training. Example of a patient may close in suffering from where there is low self-esteem to fear of commitment. If an unqualified individual leads that patient to believe that he or she was molested as a child, the patient will accept that information in a desire to please the therapist, even though the information is false. A well-trained hypnotherapist will not lead the patient, but will guide that person. An example of leading versus to guide is as follows. After the patient has reached a relaxed state of tranquility, if the hypnotherapist is leading, he or she will then ask, who is that man or woman with you? And suggest an answer. What is he doing or she doing to you? Again, suggesting an answer. The guide would be slightly different. Where are you? Wait for an answer. Is there anyone with you? If not, change the scenes. If so, is it a man or a woman? Wait for an answer. What is happening? The hypnotherapist will not make any suggestion, but they allow the patients to develop any memory, if any. If the practitioner is not well trained in simple age regression therapy, he or she can do a great deal of damage to the patient by creating a situation that can exacerbate the trauma and cause individual problems to develop. The above with leading rather than guiding happens much too often by unqualified individuals. The most important reason for this bill to succeed is for the protection of the people of Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity to testify before this committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions any one of you may have.
Yes. Representative Tomac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your testimony, Doctor, and I forgive you for not having the correct vice chair. Doctor, in looking through the bill, I'm wondering why it's been directed that none of the members of the board would be a psychologist, psychological associate, or a licensed professional counselor.
I think you're not reading correctly. The amendment states that one member of the board must be among that profession.
I'll read it to you. Four members shall be hypnotherapists who are licensed.
Actually, if I could interrupt, we don't have the amendments yet. The amendments do speak to that.
Thank you.
The amendment does make that provision.
We're expecting the amendment sometime today, and but the doctor had a conflict with this afternoon's meeting, so I'm letting him testify. But there is significant amendments to this bill.
Okay, thank you.
I can assure you, we do want something of that field in the board.
I would assume so.
Yes,
thank
ma'am. You.
Any other questions? Doctor, thank you very much, and I want to commend you for your patience and persistence. This overnight success has only taken you how many years?
8 years.
Okay. So
four different legislative sessions.
And for those who weren't with us last session, this was an issue that we brought up and ran into all sorts of problems, and we believe the problems have now been solved. So.
Good.
So, thank you very much. Yeah. Well, I don't have anything. Well, I'd rather wait until we have amendments. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3153. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2884. Sandy, now we're back to the top of the agenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2884 is it extends the exception for the certificate of need process to closed system long-term care facilities built after, and it is blank in the bill, that initiate new institutional health services and admit non-resident patients. You have a dash one amendment in front of you, and they're here to speak to the amendment and the bill. We have the department and the association. Sorry.
Let's have the department up first. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to speak to giving you a little background on the Certificate of Need program here in the state of Oregon and why the department opposes this bill and would oppose the amendments as well. And with me is Julia Huddleston, who's with our fiscal services that works with senior and people with disabilities unit on nursing home facilities, and she's going to provide more specific information on fiscal issues. The Certificate of Need program has actually been with us for over 30 years now and came out of this health systems planning efforts of the 1960s and the 1970s. And nursing facilities, nursing homes have been part of Certificate of Need, covered under Certificate of Need for 30 years now. The program rose out of the legislature's desire. It was a legislative initiative to achieve reasonable access to health care services and a reasonable cost. So there was a real balance here by making sure that enough services were available, but then also constraining the growth of those services so that we would be providing things in an efficient manner. And the way the CN program has done that is using two primary strategies. First, to attempt to limit the number of beds so that the facilities are running as efficient occupancy rates. And then secondly, to make sure that if we are approving programs, that they're being done in a cost-effective and fiscally responsible manner. In the past, and for the majority of the history of the Certificate of Need program, we covered not only long-term care facilities, nursing homes, but also the acute care side of things as well. So all hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers were covered as well. However, in 1995, due to a sunset clause, there was a possibility for the legislature to change the Certificate of Need program, and at that time, the legislature decided to exempt all of acute care except for the building of new hospitals. And at that time, the department did not oppose that exemption of acute care facilities because we felt at that time that there were market forces, marketplace forces in effect that would limit the number of new beds, new services being built and provided, and consequently there was no need for Certificate of Need in that portion of the industry. We did not feel at that time and continue to not believe that there are those similar market forces in long-term care, and consequently that is why we believe that Certificate of Need needs to continue for nursing home facilities. Currently, right now, 70% of the states, that's 36 of the 50 states, do have Certificate of Need, although it's not always called that. Of the 14 states that do not have a Certificate of Need program, 8 of those states have a moratorium on the building of new nursing home beds. Consequently, what we're seeing is that 44 out of the 50 states believe that there needs to be some kind of constraint on the proliferation of nursing home beds. Specifically speaking to House Bill 2884, what it would do is it would exempt one particular classification of nursing home care from Certificate of Need program. The closed long-term care facilities, oftentimes referred to as continuing care retirement communities, are already exempt from Certificate of Need.
Can I interrupt? Grant, I don't understand what that means, closed system facilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, what this is a system where a person, an elderly person, excuse me, wants to buy into a system where they're going to receive continuity of care. So they buy into a community that the management says, yes, we will take care of you from the time you're living in the home until you die, including nursing home care if that is needed. So you buy into this, as I see it, then the institution shares the risk with the patient that there's excessive costs. I mean, I personally believe that this is a good system, and I also believe that it is one that should be exempted from Certificate of Need because they really are outside of the rest of the market for nursing home care.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But what this bill would do is it would say that if those closed systems have extra nursing home beds, that they would then be able to open those beds to the general public and, in essence, increase the number of nursing home beds that are currently available in the system. And not only does it increase those beds, which we do not think is a good idea right now given the low occupancy rates that we're seeing, but also believe that it creates an unfair advantage for that particular part of the industry. These facilities, these institutions at this time can apply for CN to have those, to have their beds open to the general public. And in fact, last year, one of those facilities did apply for Certificate of Need, and that was granted. I believe that Julia in a little while is going to talk to you about occupancy rates, but right now what we're seeing in the state of Oregon is an occupancy rate of about 72% in nursing homes, and we know that is already not an efficient way to run businesses, that they really should be at about 80% in order to be most effective. So for those reasons is the reason why we oppose the bill, and basically what's set before you today is a policy decision on what you believe, if any, is the role for certificate of need. And we're really seeing this as dismantling a big chunk of what we would do, and I think it is a real policy decision for you to make. And then that brings me to the Dash 1 amendments, which basically does eliminate certificate of need except for new hospital construction, so that the Dash 1 amendments, all nursing home certificate of need, at least as I read it, would be gone. Again, for the reasons I've already stated, we would oppose this bill as well. We simply do not see that right now there's the marketplace forces in place for this to be a good idea. The other thing is simply on an operational basis, I find it very difficult to figure out how we would run a program where we're doing a certificate of need maybe once a decade. And so with that, I'd close, be happy to answer any questions and turn it over to Julia.
So the closed cut system would be something like the Willamette View Manor, where people buy into that? Is that what I'm...
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, I'm not familiar with Willamette View, but that is the idea. Yes, you buy into the care from the time you go into the residential facility till the time you die. And if you need that nurse skilled nursing care, that will be provided.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Julia Huddleston. I'm the administrator of the Office of Rate Setting for Finance and Policy Analysis in the Department of Human Services and the administrator of the Senior and People with Disabilities Budget Office. And I'm here today to speak in opposition to 2884 and to the Dash 1 amendments from a Medicaid funding perspective. As Grant mentioned, Certificate of Need has applied to nursing facilities in the state since 1973. This was used as a capacity planning tool, particularly successfully beginning in 1981 when the state received the first home and community-based services waiver. Since that time, Oregon has made a policy choice to grow community alternatives, which are less costly to both the private sector and to the public sector, and are the preferred choice of consumers. Given the budget uncertainties of the year 2002 and 2003, this assembly approved a department-recommended action in the fifth special session to cap the growth of Medicaid clients in community-based care. And we're looking at 2003-2005 with very limited growth of people who can go into these least costly alternatives, or less costly alternatives. However, Medicaid nursing facilities are a mandated service under Medicaid. So we're going to have to manage the system in such a way that encourages people to seek out the informal supports they have and the resources they have in the community during a time they may be on a wait list. That factor, coupled with the client reductions that have happened in the past 5 months, coupled with funding uncertainties around both nursing facilities and community-based care, make this a very unique time to attempt to insert yet another variable into the equation. We would suggest that long-term care planning be done over the continuum and capacity planning be looked at over the continuum. This committee passed out earlier this week, I believe, a bill that extends the moratorium on licensing of residential care facilities and assisted living facilities for another 2 years, which the department supported. We'd suggest that the same sort of long-term look be given to the certificate of need issue in nursing facilities. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Jim Carlson, please.
Good morning. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. Good morning, Representative Westland. We share many of the concerns, I think, that were outlined by the agency. in the sense with the bill in its original form, primarily in that some providers, one class of providers, would be exempted retroactively, essentially, from certificate of need, while the rest of the providers would still be subject to the certificate of need. And that was our primary concern with the bill as introduced. In conversations we had with proponents of the bill, we had indicated that we were much more comfortable with a level playing field, i.e., essentially everybody under it or everybody not under it, but not singling out certain classes to be exempt while leaving others under it. And there were amendments prepared on the dash ones that would essentially exempt everybody from it to level that playing field. So from our perspective, our preference is we would not be comfortable with the bill in its current form as introduced, because it would create an unlevel playing field out there amongst different categories of providers. And the dash one amendment, I think, was drafted to address that issue, to level the playing field. I don't think that addresses the concerns you heard, however, you know, coming from some at the agency level, where they've got a slightly different perspective on it than where we're coming from. Be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions. I guess a certificate of need has always mystified me that it exists. For a very discreet set of business, and it doesn't for anything else. And do you have any sense of the rationale 30 years ago as to why this was created?
Mr. Chair, I think if you go back to probably the mid-60s when Medicaid and Medicare programs were coming online, you had a large number of Americans were entitled to. And I think states, and to a lesser extent federal government, had some interest in looking at tools to help kind of control the expenditure side of that. Long-term care is fairly unique in that government is the largest purchaser or payer of services. Essentially, Medicaid's the de facto long-term care insurance program for most middle-class Americans. That's not really the way it ought to be. It's a failure, I believe, of federal policy in this program area. But I think the fact that it is a significant budget issue for state governments and for the federal government has been the primary reason why we saw it first developed and why it's probably stayed intact around the country. I mean, that'd be my best response.
But it hasn't really. I mean, if that was designed to control costs, I mean, you're either eligible or you're not, and you can get, you know, you can if you're Medicaid eligible or Medicare eligible, the level of services you get are dependent upon where you're located. So it's kind of not serving that purpose, is it?
Mr. Chair, I'd say probably the other piece that factors into it's probably looking at Medicaid and Medicare both look at what it costs to deliver the services in a nursing facility setting, since they're paying for such a large portion of it. And that's obviously been a real push-me-pull-me, you know, debate in public policy for a number of years. You know, the best example I could give you would be if you took a 100-bed nursing facility and you've got your fixed operating costs, which are pretty much the same whether you've got 50 beds occupied or you've got 100 beds occupied, your cost per day of serving an individual is going to be lower if you have 100 beds occupied than if you have 50 beds occupied. And so there is a strong, compelling public policy need to try to maintain adequate occupancy levels so that those facilities will be more cost effective when they're then, you know, determining what it's going to cost to reimburse. And so I think that factors kind of into it. I mean, this is always a very tough issue, I think, to discuss, because, I mean, generally I kind of view myself as more of a free market, you know, type of a person. And I think when you get into certainly this segment of the healthcare market, or, I mean, I guess we've got other analogies out there on how we manage natural resources or, you know, other things where government does come in where they feel there's a compelling public policy need, you know, to manage in certain marketplaces, utilities, other things like that. But it's always, you know, I agree with you. It's always a tough one to pin down specific dollars and cents to.
Well, I guess from my perspective, if I'm going to if I'm in the business and I'm going to build a nursing facility, you know, I'm just not going to say, well, I'll just build it over there and I'm sure people will show up. You know, I'm gonna go in on the front end and determine market before I do construction, and then so you go in and you do your study and you determine viability, and then you go through this other process for the state to determine something that you should be determining before you even cite. So I'm just wondering if this duplication makes sense.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, there's certainly some elements to it. If I were to go into Roseburg right now and build a brand new state-of-the-art modern healthcare facility, nursing facility, you've got two other large nursing facilities in that community, Mercy and Rosehaven. What you would probably see happen, just using that example, would be your private pay mix, which is really key to having a private pay mix to keeping a facility financially viable, because you're basically cost shifting your Medicaid losses, which in Oregon are about $23 a day right now. You're cost shifting that into your private pay mix and the small Medicare margins. So what would happen is, if you took Mercy and Rosehaven, just using that example, and the private pay in that community gravitated away from those two facilities, went to the new facility, you probably end up with a successful new facility, but jeopardizing the status of the two existing. I think that's the theory, the philosophy behind looking at this. And so I think that's where the concern has stemmed from historically, is what that does if you've got that kind of a dynamic in a distinct service area.
Well, and I can understand that, but you know, by the same token, if I'm looking to site a facility and I've done my study of Roseburg and found out that all the needs of this client population would be met, I'm not going to say I'm going to go in there and do all this venture capital on the assumption that I'm going to be able to capture market.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, we've had a lot of internal discussion around this legislation around certificate of need. And, you know, I'll be real honest, I don't have consensus amongst, you know, my membership. I've got some of my members who just, you know, pure and simple would not like to have a certificate of need process at all. I've got other of my members who I think say, yeah, it's kind of a necessary evil. And so we have, you know, ongoing discussions around this, and we've had quite a bit of discussions around this particular legislation, and where we came down at our public policy committee level was that if the bill was going to move forward, if it was going forward, we felt that you needed to level the playing field out by saying we don't exempt just one class of providers, you should exempt everyone from it if the bill's going to move forward. If the committee chooses not to move on the bill, then it becomes a moot point. But that was where we came down on the discussion. We probably spent, I'd say, a good hour on this particular bill at our public policy committee meeting last month, which was far longer discussion than we had even on the serious budget issues we face.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't catch him. These are your Dash 1 amendments?
The Dash 1 amendments came from, I think, at our request in response to the conversations we had with the proponents of the legislation.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What's the committee's feeling? The chair would not be interested in this bill without the Dash 1, but, you know, to a degree, this has been an issue that's been floating for a long time. I kind of would like to move it and get it over to the Senate so it could be in the hands of Senator Fisher, who is an absolute expert in these things, seeing how he spent 30 years in the nursing home business or better, and let him kind of play with it. Bill and or Senator Fisher and I have had discussions about this. What do you think, Bubba?
We have the Dash 1s.
We have the Dash 1s. They are in your packet. They're right there.
Well, let's get Senator Fisher.
Okay. Representative Westlam moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2884. Any discussion? Any objections to the dash ones? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a recommendation.
Representative Westlam moves House Bill 2884 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I'm sorry I was late, Mr. Chair, but I mean that I was called to testify on something else. Has the dash twos or the dash, I mean, the dash threes been talked about at all?
We're on 2884.
I'm sorry. Oh, I was told the wrong one. That will help. That would help.
Hey, Barker, get with the program.
Are you two children?
She looked the wrong stack.
Okay.
She said this one.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It's my perception this is not a problem. And so I guess it's unclear to me why we're even thinking about moving this. It seems like this it's working well now. Why are we trying to change it?
Well, I guess from my perspective, the argument that this is the way we've always done it is not a good argument.
I concur with that.
You know, I think from my study of it, and one of the reasons I'd like to get it to Senator Fisher, maybe he doesn't want to do this. I haven't had a conversation with him. But my sense is that this was a process that was put in place at the beginning of a massive federal ramp-up of health care assistance and trying to kind of have controls on it. But it's something that at this point in time, I think the market can take care of by itself without state intervention. So that's my opinion.
Well,
so,
if I may follow up then, you know, I think traditionally I would agree with you that let the market take care of it. We're talking about offices, that kind of thing. Let the market take care of it. But we're talking about senior citizens who need a place to live. I think that we have some responsibility to invest in that, in the sense that it's our responsibility to regulate that somewhat. And it seems to me that that's what the current situation is.
Well, but then the argument is we don't have certificate of need for assisted living facilities and that's working, why do we need them for nursing homes? You know, we're regulating part of that industry, not the other part. So, I mean, admittedly, we did put a moratorium on construction, that's different because that's going away. So, I mean, that was to explore explore options as to how we dealt with it, and we haven't moved to this model for them. So, Representative Barker.
I tend to agree with what Representative Tomei is saying on this. The people who are going into Medicare and Medicaid, people who are going into the long-term care, I think, do need that price protection so it doesn't get out of whack. The legislature doesn't seem to block at the PUC controlling trucking and so on, which is certainly more of a private enterprise system, which I would think wouldn't need the regulation that it's very strict. In fact, reading the front page of why we have the PUC for trucks is like something out of Eastern Europe. But anyway, I can't support moving this bill, so thank you.
Okay, I'm going to... That's okay. I can close the work session with a motion on the table, I believe, can I? Yeah. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2884. We may or may not bring it back up later in the day and open a work session on 2964. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I too have a huge fall. 2964. Expands the type of organizations that may own or operate dental clinics or offices. That allows actively licensed dentists to be responsible for a clinical practice of dentistry in the dental office or clinic requires retention of the patient's records and records of supervising dentists, allows certain fiduciaries for dentists of estates and deceased dentists to retain ownership interest in the dental clinic or office for a limited period. We received testimony on this the early part of April. You should have the dash one amendments, which is modifying the ownership percentage, deleting 51%, increasing it to 75%. That's the dash one amendments. The dash two amendments, and I apologize that we don't have a hand engrossed of all of these, but they are pretty straightforward. The dash two amendments are deleting the minority ownership portion of the bill on page 2 and 3. And we also have received the dash three amendments, which were brought forward by the Dentourist Association, requesting that they be included, exempting the technology from the dental ownership language in current statute. And if you don't have any of those amendments, let me know.
Boy, I'm totally confused.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a few remarks. I feel very strongly that we do need to provide for the types of facilities that are in the bill already. The labor organizations have the ability to own a dental clinic. The School of Dentistry is an important function. Local governments can form clinics. Institutions that are training institutions can also, nonprofits. There are a number of different entities that are very important to provision to and also migrant clinics, very, very important. There are good reasons for these clinics, and we should continue them. But we don't need an invasion of merchants trying to help dentistry do better. Dentistry is generally a cottage-type industry with one or two doctors and staff, different than medicine or hospital care. It seeks to rely on a close relationship of trust between the patient and the doctor. Few patients stay around a dental office where they mistrust the treatment, fees, or people involved in their care. They're seeking professional treatment. Part of the dictionary definition of a professional is characteristic of or befitting a profession or one engaged in professional conduct and professional ethics, as opposed to a business. Now, many businesses are becoming more professional, but dentistry has long been built on the trust and relationship, those ethics and conducts, and melding art and science. Is my doctor seeking my best interest? Is my doctor attempting to do the very best procedure at the most reasonable fee? Heaven knows there are rotten apples in every barrel, but let's not let the high ideals of our professionals become driven by the almighty dollar. Business has not kept the standards and the ethics and the conduct of the professions. Look at Enron and Global Crossing and WorldCom, and you see what happens when business becomes the goal, when money becomes the goal. Where there's fraud in the profession, we have peer review committees to weed it out, but let's make the bar easier to jump. A leading young dental student, in fact, the president of the student body at OHSU, wrote recently, and I'd like to just quote some items from his letter briefly. I'm a junior, dear representative, I'm a junior dental student at OHSU, and writing on behalf of my fellow dental students in strong opposition to HB 2964. Any percentage ownership of a dental practice by a non-dentist threatens the doctor-patient relationship. As a health care provider, it's my moral and ethical obligation to do what is best for my patients. Each percentage point of non-dentist ownership allowed translates to a proportional reduction of my ability to fulfill my obligation to my patient. A non-dentist looking to profit off the services dentists provide is not accountable to the bodies created to protect the public and ensure standard of care, such as the Oregon Board of Dentistry and peer review. This is not the time to change our standards. In a world around us that's crazed by making money in any way possible, let's shield these young, strong professionals from the challenges of business-driven dentistry. Patients will be better for it. Really, who gains from this? Not the patient. If business-driving billing for more care or driving the cost of procedures higher to gross more, why else would a businessman want to become a partner in a dental practice? I greatly respect hospital care, but is that a business? Have fees gone higher over the past years? Let's not try to organize dentistry into large megastory complexes where the costs go skyward. Let's let the great majority of dentists do what they feel is best for their patients and themselves. This bill has already passed the Senate without the ownership provision. I ask you to support, and I move -2 amendments so that we can pass this bill without the membership, the ownership section.
Any other discussion? Very nice speech, by the way.
Thank you.
However, I don't happen to agree with it, but it was still. I left a pause in there. I don't know.
Could we vote on the speech, Mr. Chair?
Just for the committee's information, the Senate passed out of Senator Fisher's committee yesterday a bill that's identical to this, except that it does not have the ownership piece in it. It has all the other pieces of this bill in it, except the ownership piece. So the fact that, I mean, so to a degree, we could just take this down to be an ownership, but I think it's part of a comprehensive package. Like it was stated early on, there are, I think, 10 points here, and there was agreement on 9, and it wasn't a slam dunk on the other one. So it would be, so we brought it here, and we're just going to see what happens. And the chair would be interested in a motion on the -1 amendment.
-2.
Oh, you moved the -2?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I was so engrossed in your speech, I didn't hear that you made a motion.
Okay. Look, I'm not Winston Churchill.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor, and the motion is the -2 amendment, which would delete the language on ownership. Any discussion on the -2? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three very dear friends who are dentists, and I always go to them. I know Memphis received a lot of testimony on this from dentists, and it's pretty much a form letter that I've received from those that I've emailed. But I go talk to my friends who are dentists, and one of them did not want to own his own practice. He instead found another dentist to own the practice and went in with him. And but if he was in a rural area, he didn't want to own the practice, he would have to find another dentist to go in with, and that isn't always the case. And so I look at this as an access issue. Another dentist who owns his own practice, he now says, well, he's now hired his own denturist in his practice, and he's the only one in his area now that has a denturist in his own practice, just because of the issues with denturists. But I won't get into that. But he told me that dentists we have been very protective of their profession, and rightly so to a certain extent. But he did tell me that it is about time that we start looking at other options so that to take care of this access issue. And so I would be opposed to the -2, but I am in favor of the -1s, by the way.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I think you're very right that there are some dentists who do feel that ownership is possible. What I'm referring to is the great majority of the Oregon Dental Association that do not feel that. And they do feel that, a doctor is more than willing or more than able to go out and associate with another doctor, and that happens all the time. I've had several different relationships where I've brought in younger doctors. They soon move out on their own when they do feel, or they have developed enough capital to be able to own their own practice. But it's the the ability to be free that I think is important, and not to be burdened by someone else owning a good part and directing your practice that is not a dentist. Okay.
Well, I'd just like to respond to that, that this doesn't require a dentist to go out and get a minority ownership. He can run his business however he wants. And, you know, the whole thing on patient care to me is, I mean, MDs have been doing this for a long time, and I haven't seen an erosion in care because of it. So, this doesn't require anything of anybody. It just creates an option, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed Monday's meeting because I was in my dentist's office being attacked by Attila the hygienist. I spoke with him about this bill, and he was familiar with it, and he was adamant that this would be a bad thing for dentistry in Oregon. And I also heard from other dentists in essentially the form letter, but I'm going to trust my dentist, my doctor, who, in his opinion on that matter. So he said he'd looked into it thoroughly and did not want private ownership in the dentistry. So thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting. Even before I was sworn in as a lawmaker, my dentist had a conversation with me about this bill, sort of anticipating that it would come up. And I talked to him at length about this bill, and somebody I trust to provide dental services to me doesn't support this bill. But not wanting to take his answer, to base my decision on, I just his answer, I sought the advice of another dentist in my district, and I called him, and we had a great discussion about this, and he didn't support it. And so, you know, there are people that I look to for advice, and I trust their opinions based on their experience. And dentists that I know and work with are telling me that they're not supportive of this bill. So I just wanted to add that input.
Well, yeah, I've got to go in for a checkup when session's over. And my dentist doesn't like this bill.
Who's your doctor?
I'm not telling you.
Don't know the name.
Don't worry, he'll know.
But, well, yeah, I went to high school with the guy, introduced him to his wife, and he's still not mad at me. So,
no Novocaine.
But, my response to him was, how would this impact your practice? And he had no response to that. So, I mean, that kind of gets the point. Anyway, any more discussion on the Dash 2s? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
She's hurrying.
I know. Sorry, Mara.
Representative
Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Delfield? Aye.
Representative Montana?
No.
Representative
Kamei?
No.
Representative Weston?
Nope.
No. The Dash 2 amendments, having failed to receive the majority, are failed. Representative Monis Anderson.
I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Monis Anderson moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2964. Y'all want to just vote this time, or shall we discuss it again? Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Barker.
No.
Representative Delta.
No.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Kamei.
Yes.
Representative Weston.
Aye.
Aye. The Dash 1 amendments, having received the constitutional majority, are declared adopted. The Dash 3s are relatively new. Do we have questions on them?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes. The Denturist Association came to me and said, would I submit these? And I said, yes, but I don't have a feeling one way or another, and I would prefer to have you have Joe Koss come forward to this.
Okay. That works. Joe?
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, we did receive some written testimony on this bill that I'd like to just acknowledge into the record from the Oregon State Denturist Association and the United Seniors of Oregon. It should be at your place.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Koss, and I come before you today on behalf of the Oregon State Denturist Association to discuss a proposed amendment to House Bill 2964, legislation which, among other things, delineates who may own or operate a dental clinic or office. I served as the campaign coordinator for ballot measure 24, which passed by an overwhelming 3-to-1 margin in the November 2002 general election. Measure 24 did two things. First, it allowed Oregon's licensed denturists to expand their legal scope of practice to include partial dentures. Of equal importance is that this measure authorized, and I quote from the measure, licensed denturists and licensed dentists to cooperate and maintain mutually agreeable business and professional associations, with each responsible for their own area of expertise. As originally written, House Bill 2964 creates confusion concerning a denturist's ability to own and operate their clinics and offices. The intent of Measure 24 was to ensure that it is possible for a denturist to do so, with any dentists employed at that clinic being responsible for their specific areas of expertise. Rather than go through the process of word crafting this fairly straightforward legislative effort designed to clarify issues surrounding the ownership by a dentist of their own clinics or offices, we would prefer to be specifically excluded from this bill. To do so not only focuses the intent of this legislation on its original purpose, it reaffirms that the denturist profession, including the operation of denturist offices and clinics, falls under the jurisdiction of Oregon Revised Statute 680. It also avoids potential conflicts with the language found in Ballot Measure 24. To accept and integrate this amendment into House Bill 2964 will correct what I would like to believe is an honest oversight by the bill sponsor and maintain continuity between the Dental Practices Act as amended by this bill and the public's intent as expressed by voting Measure 24 into law. Thanks for your attention. I'll answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Jane, would you come up and give us some rebuttal?
Sure. Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, and we would be opposed to the dash three amendments from the Denturist Association. A couple of things. When the ballot measure was passed, it has quite a broad statement to allow denturists to create any kind of business relations, professional relationships with dentists, as it's very unstructured, and it was amended into their part of the statute, the part that is about licensing and discipline of denturists. And I think the public could rely on that. Was a very broad grant of power. At the same time, the Dental Practices Act has the ownership of dentist practices to be maintained by dentists. That is a form of patient protection that keeps people with without the same training from having employees who they're directing and controlling who would be dentists to do that. So what I'm saying is you don't need to make that amendment to the statute. The denturists have a very broad grant of power from the voters to create any kind of relationship, as long as it's not an illegal relationship. I mean, they can't do any kind of kickbacks or splits or things like that. But you've already heard testimony, I think, from Representative Monez Anderson that there are denturists and dentists working together. So the ballot measure made that pretty clear. And the ownership law is not going to impede that. It does present a little bit of protection, which I think the voters relied upon. And if the bills go forward with percent of ownership, they certainly could be part of that percentage. As non-dentists, there is no restriction on the percent of ownership, what classes of owners those might be. So I guess my plea to you is don't add that part. It would make the bill, which is already controversial, super controversial for a lot of people. So
So you are opposed to the dash threes?
Mm-hmm. Opposed to the dash threes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jane, I'm having a little trouble understanding how this would be detrimental either to dentists or to their patients. Dash threes.
The dash threes?
Right.
It exempts the effect of the dash three is it says the denturist in creating the relationships that they can do under their statute could are completely exempt from the ownership law of you should be a dentist or have 75% of your practice be a dentist if that's the amendment the committee chooses. They could be the total owner of a dental practice. They could employ dentists. We don't think that's a good idea. I mean, you're talking about people who have generally about 2 years of education. They didn't go to dental school. I mean, you're asking them to be employers of the dentist, and it's just not a good arrangement. I think the voters could rely on the fact that there is the other prohibition in the Dental Practice Act that says you have to be a licensed dentist to own and operate a dental practice. We don't want to get into the situation. There have been some situations where, in the past, the denturists who were delivering partial dentures before the statute was changed were the ones that did all the work without any regard to a diagnosis for the need or how the thing was designed, and the patient then ends up at a dental office saying, "This doesn't work for me." I guess the more I talk about it, probably I'm getting some kind of cloudy looks. I'll put it this way. I mean, we're told the voters have spoken. The denturists wrote the ballot measure and promoted the ballot measure. I mean, their interest groups funded the ballot measure campaign. They knew this other law was there. They didn't amend it. Now, the voters, do they have a right to rely on it without the legislature changing it? We were told, actually in front of this committee, when we said we have some problems with what the voters granted the denturists, that you don't want to go down that to try to make amendments in the statute at that point. So I know there's a lot of desire on the legislature to allow the denturists to work with as much freedom as they can. They can have partnerships with dental practices. Their statute is pretty clear that it says pretty much any agreement, any kind of business arrangement.
Follow up?
Yes.
So right now they can own and operate their own clinics. Denturists
right.
can.
Right. And they actually have an exclusion from the having to have a license to practice dentistry is also in the statute. So
what would the amendment do
right now
to change that?
The amendment would say that if you're a denturist, you can create any business arrangement with a dental office. You could hire a dentist. You could direct
and
the dentist.
That's not yes. possible now.
I would say that this
to do that.
The ownership law and the Dental Practices Act is an impediment to that form of arrangement where you would actually employ a dentist and direct the dentist as to what the diagnosis would be, et cetera. Yeah, a fully owned
in
practice.
Some ways, Jane, it seems like that would be a benefit to the public to have a dentist operating in the same office as a denturist.
Well, they can operate in the same office. I mean, I'm going to eliminate the protocol here a little bit. The denturist and the dentist can operate in the same office today.
So
it's ownership.
It has to do with, the way the law is set up now, the person who's doing the diagnosis is the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you assure that is you have ownership saying you have to be licensed as a dentist to operate the dental office to make sure the patients get a diagnosis. So if you exclude that, then what you're basically saying is you can create an arrangement where the denturist who has a much more limited scope of practice can tell the dentist, as my employee, you will, this will be the diagnosis. This person needs a partial denture. I don't want you to explain to them that they might have a implant-supported denture or any of the other good stuff that might be available.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Maybe I'm asking the wrong person, but I think you'd probably be aware. How much training does the denturist have? Is it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, but the statute calls for an associate degree. There are no associate degrees in denture technology that I'm aware of, except maybe in Canada. This is a very limited kind of practice that's allowed in, I think it's six states in the United States allow denturists to practice. And the other states, if they're practicing, they're practicing dentistry without a license. The education is pretty much in our state met by an equivalency standard, which says you take courses, you come to the health division or the health licensing office, and you demonstrate to us that you've had an equivalent education for the two-year degree, and then you sign up to work with a denturist to do your actually fabricating the denture, and that's how you meet the licensing requirement in the state. It's very, very loose in order to accommodate a profession that is not widespread in use in the United States. So they didn't go to dental school. I think that confuses a lot of patients who think it's some kind of subspecialty of dentistry, which it is not.
Would you, as a follow-up, would you estimate that they have taken microbiology and pharmacology and physiology and all the basic sciences that, say, are given in dental school?
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I don't know the direct answer to that question. I'm trying to remember their statute has some requirements of some courses. I'm at a loss at the moment to remember. It's not a four-year. It's pretty much, it's kind of put together to accommodate some who might have taken some courses in this dental assistant programs or dental hygiene programs or dental technologists who make dentures. They have a lot of programs around the United States for them. So it's hard to say exactly how they meet it. Some from foreign countries are able to meet it. If this make it clearer, this was a note, an email from the director of the Board of Dentistry to the director of the Health Licensing Office on the issue. And she says in it that she double-checked with the Board of Dentistry's Attorney General Assistant, and she reiterated that it is her belief that the wording in the ballot measure regarding cooperation and maintaining a business relationship or association between dentists and denturists and the issues raised in, and she's referring to the two ownership bills, the Senate and this bill, 2964, are separate and distinct. The language in ballot measure 24 will be codified in ORS 680 and will be in effect no matter what happens with either of these two bills. So, I mean, that was her advice, that they don't really impact each other directly. You don't have to change the law to allow the ballot measure to control the situation.
Well, thank you, Jane. A brief unofficial poll of the committee. It seems to me that the Dash 3 amendments have a constitutional issue here. So, in other words, I don't think they're supposed to pass it. There's no motion on the Dash 3s. We have the bill with the Dash 1s adopted. I would entertain a motion on the bill.
I move House Bill 2964 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Monis Anderson moves House Bill 2964 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? I did say as amended, I believe. Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
No.
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 Yes. Yes.
Aye. House Bill 2964, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. And Representative Bates.
Will carry. Would you like a little rebar?
Okay. I've got the wild fish bill and the marijuana bill this week. I got to give something to Representative Bates here. I'm going to close the work session on 2964. I'll be there to back him up, of course.
Yeah. Way back.
Can we go here now? Okay, I'm going to open our work session on 3506. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3506 is at the request of the Mid-Rogue Independent Physicians Association. It's directing the Department of Human Services to seek a waiver to deny eligibility for medical assistance otherwise eligible applicant who is pregnant and is serving as a surrogate mother.
Okay, I'm going to let Representative Anderson do the introductions. And we also have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Gordon Anderson, representative from District 3, Grants Pass, Chosen County. We had two bills before the committee until yesterday, I believe, and I'm not even sure my colleague here from Grants Pass was able to be brought up to date on the one. We were seeking some changes in eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, but the chair is and the audit committee are looking at some fairly major changes in eligibility, and therefore we have stepped back and dropped this bill. I believe it was 3515.
Okay. Just for the record, not changes in eligibility, changes in accountability of the eligibility system.
Fine tuning. I would like to introduce a colleague and a friend from Grants Pass who is the medical director for the Mid-Rogue IPA. Our last governor came down several times and complimented us on our IPA as being probably the best in the state in terms of efficiency. MRIPA, as it's called, has done a wonderful job in managing care for those who need health care through Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid. And that's greatly as a result of the direction given by the executive director, Doug Flo, but even more so by Dr. Lyle Jackson. Dr. Jackson has been very well respected in our community for many, many years in practice, and now he's taken over as the manager for the IPA. And it was his thought, along with those in the board of directors for the IPA, that this bill, 3506, would have some very important aspects. So I'll turn it over to him for his testimony. Thank you, Lyle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm a family practice doctor. Came here in Oregon in 1977. I practiced in Grants Pass since until approximately year 2000. Since at that time, I retired from active practice and became the medical director of Mid-Rogue IPA, which is a 75-member IPA in Josephine County.
Doctor, could I interrupt for a moment? For the record, could you give us your name, please?
I'm Lyle Jackson, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you.
And represent Mid-Rogue IPA, which is a 75-member IPA. Virtually every doctor in Josephine County participates in the Oregon Health Plan, and that's really unusual in comparison to other areas of the state. We're a firm believer of the Oregon Health Plan. We understand how it works, and we think it serves the most needy people of Josephine County. As Representative Anderson can testify, Josephine County is a poor county. It's one of the two highest counties in the state with a percentage of people in the Oregon Health Plan. Over a five-year period of time, approximately 38% of people, 38% of people in Josephine County were on the Oregon Health Plan at one time. It's a major player in the state. During these tough times when there's limited money, the IPA, myself, and my staff and most importantly, the doctors in Josephine County have felt the pain of what the cutbacks have done to the most needy people of the county. And we understand the hard work of the committees trying to get the best, the most treatment for the, with the least amount of dollars. However, coming across cases, there are a very small number of people, but definitely a number of people who abuse the system. And we author two bills to help to rectify that. One of the bills is Bill 3506, and that has to do with surrogate mothers. And I recognize the numbers are small, but it's the nature of what a surrogate mother is makes me and our organization against allowing surrogate mothers to participate in the Oregon Health Plan. In our county, we have, with Mid-Rogue IPA and the other managed care Oregon Health Management Systems, which is run by the Grants Pass Clinic, we have come across approximately five members over the last several years who have been surrogate mothers. And I want to make it clear on the record that we are not against having surrogate mothers to enhance being able to bring forth children for the people who are infertile, for couples who are infertile. But it should not be done on the taxpayer's back. Usually when I was practicing, I delivered babies for 20 years. I received requests from young couples, needy couples for infertility who wanted to outreach for mothers to help them carry one of their children so they could adopt the child. And I participated in that because I felt there's a need. But I don't think that should be carried on the back of the Oregon taxpayer. We have several members who are members of the Oregon Health Plan who made arrangements in private through a lawyer, are being paid and for the medical care, for their housing, for any medical expenses. And after delivering the baby, they will give the baby over to the adoptive family. During this time, they sign up for the Oregon Health Plan. I think that's a private partnership between the surrogate mother and the adoptive family. By signing up for the Oregon Health Plan, the taxpayers of Oregon are financially responsible for any complications of the mother and of the child. I think that should be the responsibility of the adoptive family. And not taxpayers. One case particularly that was most bothersome was the adoptive family took the child, was from the state of Washington. So the taxpayers of Oregon paid for that prenatal care, paid for the perinatal care and postnatal care and neonatal care of the child, and then took the child out of the state of Oregon. I just don't think that's right. And during these times of tight money, I really feel that this is a loophole that should be stopped. And again, the numbers are not high, but I think it's sending a message to the people of the good taxpayers of Oregon that we will not allow this to happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the representative committees. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, how are you going to tell who the baby is?
I acknowledge that that's a problem. We heard about this through three different ways. The members, the actual mothers, have come up and told us, saying that I'm a surrogate mother, and we want you, the Oregon Health Plan, to pay for it. We hear from doctors who says this person's a surrogate mother. And we also heard from caseworkers who said this person's a surrogate mother. I do recognize proving it will be difficult. It will be difficult. But I think if you make it a law, then I'm appealing to the higher natures of lawyers who are instrumental of bringing this about to recognize that it's against the law to have the mother sign up for the Oregon Health Plan. And by doing that, it will stop the abuse of the system.
Thank you. I just follow up, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I smiled at the higher calling of lawyers. Whenever I have a daughter who's a lawyer.
My daughter is engaged to a lawyer.
Defense attorney.
I can foresee. I mean, one of the things I can possibly foresee is somebody who is in this position suddenly decides they're going to jump out of it. Then we're facing an abortion if they're going to terminate the pregnancy. I mean, I can't believe that's what you're hoping for in any way or shape or form.
No. The purpose is not to promote abortion. The purpose of this, if this becomes law, then hopefully this will be, this change in policy will be disseminated to people who are either potential mothers, but more importantly, there's probably just a few number of lawyers who do this part of their business, and they will advise that this coverage for the mother is no longer available. What bothers me is that my understanding, I know personally from friends who became surrogate parents, who adopted a child through this, is that they financially take the responsibility of taking care of that mother, both from housing and food and shelter, but also for medical costs. And so these mothers should have the financial resources to be taken care of.
If I may follow up on that, it would seem to me that if they're getting that financial help, they'd be ineligible for the Oregon Health Plan. That they could be covered, and so I don't see why we need the laws.
Well, we've asked this question on every time to the OMAP or the Oregon Health Plan, and their answer is the way the law states right now is that they can't turn down these people. I think part of the reason is that they sign up for, during the way it's administered now, if you're pregnant and your level of income is a certain amount, you could qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. They don't check to see if the mother receives any payment after that point in time. So if the mother who decides to become a surrogate mother makes an arrangement with through a lawyer to become a surrogate mother, and then says sign up for the Oregon Health Plan, then receives a lump of money to take care of her during that time, and she is not required, even though I think morally she should be, to report that, but that doesn't happen in reality. If these mothers receive money through the lawyer for their care, it's not reported, and therefore the social agencies involved in terms of eligibility can't act on it.
I don't know if you would know the answer to this, but wouldn't the tax man IRS, wouldn't that have to be reported as income? Wouldn't that show up somewhere? If my wife is to be a surrogate mother and somebody's paying her a lot of money, I wouldn't think that would just be a freebie.
I'm not a lawyer or a tax man. I just know from dealing with managing our 6,000 lives in Josephine County on the Oregon Health Plan, working with the caseworkers, working on the DHS side of it, you raise these issues and they're basically saying there's nothing we can do about it. And that's why I find it so frustrating, because the taxpayers of Oregon are paying for a service they shouldn't have to pay for.
And one brief follow-up, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, of the 6,000, you said there was five people, and you're in 6,000 people are on the plan. Over how many years was the five? Is the five people that we're talking about?
I would just estimate this to be about 2 years.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But let me, if you don't mind, let me add one person is on. This is her third pregnancy. Third pregnancy.
Third surrogate.
Yes.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Jackson, if I understand correctly, you're saying that if we had a law like this, it would help prevent women from saying, I can
I can raid the OHP and be paid for that. It might give them some cause to think I need to do it through an attorney, have this funded through private sources. Is that?
Yes, you know, I feel this is will appeal not only to the mothers, but also to the lawyers who are negotiating between the parents and the surrogate mother, adoptive parents and the surrogate mother.
Follow up, just two comments, well, comment and a question. I have a brother-in-law and sister-in-law that just adopted a young little boy from Korea, and the costs to them were about $20,000. And I see a real area where this needs to be done on a private basis. They were willing to go to Korea to get a child. It probably could cost us a lot less without the Korean government fees of $7,000 to have babies, surrogate babies here, and be done privately, not done in the Oregon Health Plan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'd like to add two comments. This is a free enterprise venture between a needy couple and a woman who's willing to give up her lease as a birth mother of the child. It should not be part of the government function of that to support that and to subsidize that. Number two, I want to make it very clear by definition that women in the Oregon Health Plan are high risk from a socioeconomic point of view. And so we're at financial risk for complications of that mother and child. If you have a bad baby, it could run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I don't think that's what the taxpayers of Oregon will want to do.
Yeah, one follow-up. I just wanted to ask you a question. You are a physician. You retired several years ago, but were you delivering babies at that time when you retired?
I retired in the year 2000. My last baby was 1998 or 99. It was a rule for me, not a rule, but a goal for me that I was quit doing OB when I delivered somebody I delivered, and that happened. And I felt that was a good milestone to back off. And I delivered approximately 1,000 babies in Josephine County.
1,000 babies. Do you think that if you were practicing right today and somehow that limit was in your mind, you could practice OB now with the malpractice liability insurance going where it is?
I think it really, in lights, I know this is a different issue, but in the light of everything else that's happening in the business of medicine, I think it would be very hard for a family practice and doctor in Josephine County, as in Douglas County, to deliver babies.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Andrea.
Thank you. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We do oppose this bill. I think Representative Barker started off with one of the most important questions, which is how this will ever be enforced. We're going to start asking women why they're pregnant and start invading a very personal, private area and reproductive choices. But we have a number of other flaws that we see with this legislation. This would affect women who are not even compensated in any manner from receiving Medicaid assistance. A woman could be doing this for a sister who is infertile or who has other medical health care problems that prohibit her from even being able to become pregnant and not doing it for any compensation, and as such would be barred from having the necessary health care to have a healthy baby. What if the woman changes her mind during the pendency of the pregnancy and decides not to give up the child at birth? She would be excluded from this. And this would bar all medical coverage, including any conditions unrelated to the pregnancy. So someone already on the health plan who's got other medical conditions would be removed. And we do not believe that's good policy or practice. By removing access to Medicaid, we also believe there could be unintended consequences. The pregnancy, there could be health-related problems. And are we going to, again, do such a sweeping policy that we are not going to have the primary focus being healthy babies being born in Oregon? If a woman does encounter serious health problems, the other unintended consequences could be she could start considering options that she didn't want to, that she may not carry the to full term and choose another options to terminate. In addition, not having in front of me what the definition of surrogacy, but if the woman plans to go ahead with the pregnancy, finds that she is pregnant, and then decides to give up the child at birth for adoption, does that not sweep in the role she's playing? She is a surrogate. She intends not to be, to give up her rights, her legal rights to the child, and as such is a surrogate for someone, even if the person is not named or known at the time. Finally, we do think there might be potential constitutional infirmities under the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 20, Privileges and Immunities Sections. We are denying access based on gender, based on pregnancy, and a reason for the pregnancy. So we raise those concerns with you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
Do you believe that under the term of surrogate, if somebody is, for example, a young unwed mother who says, I don't want to go to have an abortion. I'm going to bury this child and give it away for adoption at birth. You believe that might fall under this or would fall under this statute as a surrogate?
Chair Cruz, Representative Barker, I'm not comfortable giving a full legal analysis saying one way or another. I raise that as a concern and a potential, and I don't know if the ORS has a definition of what surrogate is. But certainly surrogacy can be a broad concept, and it's a carrying, I believe, you know, the general sense of for someone else. It doesn't necessarily require that you know who it is, and as such, we think it could sweep in that situation.
Well, thank you. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Dalton.
Mr. Chair, do we have any sense of how many sort of surrogate mother operations are performed every year, or how many people birth? Thank you. I say operations in a general term.
Representative Dalton, I'm not sure you're qualified to ask this question.
Don't pick up the Mr. Chair.
Do we have a sense? Is there somebody out there in the world that has a sense?
Well, I think we
did. He answered. He was answered. There were five in the last 2 years.
Thank you. In his area.
In Grants Pass.
Chair Cruz, Representative Belto. I mean, that's sort of secondhand, as far as I understand. It's sort of anecdotal. And I certainly don't know, but these are very personal, private decisions, and there's not something that people are going to necessarily register or discuss. And so we're not going to know. I think it's a very small world out there. You know, when things are larger, we often hear about it. And I think it's a pretty small world out there that we're talking about to begin with, let alone people who then fall into this sub-area of providing health services by the state with P. So it's like a minuscule.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
I guess I'd question that minuscule, because if we're talking, say, two in our county, or two and a half, say two every year times 36 counties average, we're talking about close to 100 people, and the medical expenses on this must be significant. So we are talking about saving a fair amount of money.
Mr. Chair, I would question whether that we'd have an equal number. Certainly Multnomah County would have more.
Yeah.
But some of the eastern Oregon counties were
our
good colleague who wears the beef hat, who says there's more cows than people, probably would not have as many in that area.
There is
true, but average.
Yeah. And probably not as many surrogate human births anyway, maybe a few surrogate cow births.
Well,
let's don't get into that.
That's pretty bad.
Well, the chair scheduled this. This was originally going to be one of my work session bills, or public hearing bills, back when we thought we could do public hearings and then found out we couldn't. you know, clearly from my perspective, with the limited amount of resources we have in the, for the health plan, people who are on it that have other resources should be getting treatment in through other resources. I think there may be some federal issues unresolved with this bill. I don't think I would prefer to see a more defined definition of what we're referring to as surrogate. The conversation we had today took it all across the board, and clearly that's not the intent. So I'm not inclined to move it today, but I'm inclined to see if Representative Anderson would be willing to try to put some more definition to this, and if we can, keeping in mind that no matter what the definition is at this point in time, even if we pass the bill, it would still have to get waiver approval from CMS, which is an entirely another issue here. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on or work session. Damn it. you know, it's just tough to shift. It really is. On 3506 and open a work session on 2692.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2692 is at the request of the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. It is changing the definition of physician to include podiatrist for the purpose of physician regulatory statutes, makes conforming changes to related statutes, changes definition of physician to include podiatrist for the purposes of evidence code state regarding patient and physician privileges, and insurance code statutes protecting advocacy for patients under medical services contracts. It has a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. And we have no amendments at this time.
Okay. Representative Dalton, who do you want?
Tom Barrows and Dr. Peffley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. With me is Dr. Nick Tuffley, immediate past president of that association. House Bill 2692 seeks to change the definition of physician in Oregon statute to include doctors of podiatric medicine. In the past, there have been instances where things have been left out, payments have not been made in timely manners, and so forth, and that's what originally this bill sought to rectify. We've introduced this the last couple sessions, but have not pushed it that hard until recently when it was determined that privileges to dispense medications by podiatric physicians was in danger of being revoked, something they've been doing for years, because the staff at the Board of Medical Examiners discovered that the authorizing statute for that said physician. And so that has elevated this issue for us up higher, and that is why it's before you right now. Doctors of podiatric medicine have similar training to medical doctors and osteopaths. The federal government considers them physicians for Medicare. Unfortunately, in state statute, it refers to physicians, and so it has created confusion. That's where reimbursement problems have occurred, primarily in Medicare and Medicaid, because of the sort of disconnect between the federal definition and the state definition. I want to make it clear this is not a scope of practice issue. This does not change the scope of practice for podiatric physicians in the state in any way. And, in fact, in the writing the change in the definition, we added the term and working within the scope of their practice, which is new language for that section, to make it clear that this would not grant any additional powers to podiatric physicians. I have tried to work with all the interested parties going back several months, well before session began. The osteopaths told me early on that they were fine with the bill once it was printed. They looked at it and said they were fine with it. I had tried to get the OMA to give me an answer. I had gotten an answer about 2 weeks ago that they had concerns about the bill. The indication was that it was that the Legislative Council had missed some qualifying language, which I indicated to them and have indicated to all of you that we would be willing to change. I finally got a copy of a letter yesterday afternoon that outlined their opposition and included, it was a five-page letter that outlined a number of problems that they saw with the bill. Give us a little time to answer those, and I don't know if that letter will be included in their testimony, but I've included a four-page response to that letter, so if you get that letter from them, I think we've answered every one of their points except the potential point that Legislative Council may have missed, including MDDO rather than position under the, remember the term, the intractable pain section. And so if that's the case, and if it's inappropriate, we'd be happy to get amendments drafted to include MDDO in that section. But the timing is such that it would be difficult to do on this side. We would want to do that on the Senate side. Also yesterday afternoon, I got an indication that the Board of Medical Examiners had a problem with the bill. I'd been trying to work with them over the course of time to get an opinion. My understanding was that they were going to be looking at it, but that they had not taken a position yet. And then yesterday, prior to the board meeting tomorrow and Friday, they apparently took a position in opposition. So that obviously puts an added onus on us to try and fix any problems that they exist. It's still not clear to me where those problems are from their perspective, but we're working to try and figure that out. If this bill is moved over, we would obviously be willing to look at any amendments on the Senate side. There isn't time here, so fortunately with the timing, we're unable to make any fixes if they are needed, but I will pledge to the committee that if there are legitimate complaints or concerns, mm-hmm. we'll be willing to look at those on the Senate side.
Representative Cruz and fellow board members, representatives. My name is Richard Pepley. I'm a podiatrist. I practice here in Salem. I've been practicing here since 1994. I previously practiced in California. I was a graduate of California College of Podiatric Medicine back in 1993, so I've been in practice almost 29 years. I completed my surgical residency at Beach Community Hospital in California. Subsequently became board certified in foot and ankle surgery. I'm a fellow of American College of Foot and Ankle Surgery. I'm a clinical instructor for the Osteopathic College in Arizona. And I have rotators that from the school that comes through my office for training. Past president of Podiatric Medical Association and a delegate to our American Podiatric Medical Association, which is, I just got, if I'm a little tongue-tied, because I just got off the airplane from Washington, D.C. So I'm trying to give you a little bit of enlightenment about where we're at and why we're here today, because it seems like for 30 years, this has been an uproad battle of podiatrists and gaining their due position within the medical field. And we've achieved most things, but there's still some discrimination that is out there. We have our scope of practice, and we're very pleased with it. We, just to enlighten you on our education, we have gone to and received a college degree. We've then gone on to 4 years of medical school, followed by a residency program. There are three types of residency programs. One is a primary care residency program, in which the one-year residency is a full year of medical rotations. They are working in and with other medical residents under the same terms and conditions. They deliver babies. They administer anesthetic. They treat internal medical conditions, all as part of the medical team. That is their training. Their second year of residency is a surgical residency, and that can either be for 12 months or 24 months. The scope of practice to include ankle surgery would include those 3 years of training. we also have some programs that even go even more extensive, which include three-year programs. Why is that? Because there are such states as Florida, which allows a podiatrist to do surgery all the way to the hip, and who are considered physicians in that state. There's also fellowships that delineate people that offshoot not only into surgery, but they may go into radiography, they may go into vascular or neurological conditions or biomechanical problems. So there's a lot of interaction out there. What happens here is that when we give equal service for foot and ankle conditions, we want to be recognized on an equal par with our allopathic and osteopathic doctors. We're not asking for an increase in scope. We're just asking for a level playing field. We want parity. And we have had numerous incidences of discrimination. It is not as bad as it was in 1973. We've overcome a lot of hurdles, but we still have these small, isolated areas. I currently work here in Salem at the Willamette Surgical Center. This center was built by the orthopedists here in town, and I'm an integral part of that group. I was their experiment. We've learned to work together, and I was talking to them this morning regarding the letter that I had from OMA, and all they had was a kind of a smile on their face because of some of the issues that I want to bring up with you today. Because of the term physician and the way it's worded, there are many companies, insurance companies, that don't reimburse us at the same rate. So if you come in and have a bunionectomy by myself, and then you have one done the same way by an orthopedist, they get paid different. All we want is the same pay for the same service. We are left off of programs. Not long ago, there was a passage here in this body to allow a tax credit for physicians who wished to practice in the rural areas. Podiatry was left off. That meant we had to bring this bill back, take up your time and energy to get on it. And we were included. But again, it's taking up time. You have so many bills to hear, it's ridiculous to keep hearing them over and over. Anytime a patient is denied access to our office, increased morbidity takes place. The cost of medicine goes up significantly. Studies have shown that a ulcer, for example, in a Medicare patient who shows up in an emergency room is close to $800, whereas if that patient shows up into our office, it's $51. Significant difference in medical costs. And we're trying to think, when we think of the Oregon Health Plan and how that coverage comes across and the monies we have in there, when the patient has to go and see their primary care or the emergency room only to be referred to us, it expands the cost. And a lot of times these are established patients that we already have. So it's ridiculous that these people have to go through this chain of command to get to where they need to be. What are the facts? Well, the OMA wants to think that we're not on parity. However, in 1993, they created a committee called the Nelson Media Report, which went out and studied podiatric education and our residency programs, and it was their conclusion. It was the medical association who came up with the conclusion that there was no difference in the medical education of a podiatrist and a physician, DOMD. There were some recommendations that our scope increased during our residency program to include things such as OBGYN, because that was our weakest point. And so that has been instituted since 1993 in our residency programs. There have been studies that show that 85% of Medicare patients receive all foot care by podiatrists. We are the providers of foot and ankle health care. 75% of those who are on private insurance seek podiatric care for their foot and ankle problems. We are on by definition of Medicare physicians. Why? Because of reimbursement and availability. We're only on their list as physicians not to practice general medicine, but to practice within the scope of our medicine, medical license. I received last night the copy of the OMA's oppositions to this bill, and they began on page one with that there would be confusion. There should not be any confusion when the term physician is used, because this is a very broad term. When I have an orthopedic problem, I go to an orthopedist. I don't go under the book and look under physician and grab any physician. God forbid I should end up in an OBGYN for an orthopedic problem. So we're, as specialists, delineated who we are. According to statute, podiatrists must list themselves in all advertising and anywhere else on their business cards that they are physicians and surgeons of the foot, podiatrists. So there is no way, shape, or form that this is going to allow a podiatrist to eliminate his subspecialty within the field of medicine. They also cite that we don't have the same training. For God's sakes, we're not allowed to give general anesthetic or spinal anesthetic while we're doing surgery. Isn't that a good one? I mean, how can I do surgery and give a general anesthetic at the same time? What they fail to state is, this is what every hospital and surgical center says. If you're doing surgery, you cannot give general or spinal anesthetic. Second, surgeons don't give any kind of general anesthetic other than IV sedation, which they may monitor. Why don't they do this? It's because there's a specialty called anesthesiologists. And anesthesiologists administer these things. Yet they're all physicians. My orthopedic colleagues thought that was kind of humorous when I told them. There was a question about who's going to supervise physician assistant. Well, PAs, I'm not qualified to supervise a PA when they treat medical conditions. That's not my specialty. If I needed to supervise somebody administering foot care, I think I'm more than qualified to do that. If we were to have PA assistants that were trained in podiatry, I would assume that we as podiatrists would be given that position to do that. But I think that would be defined at the BME level and not at this level. They cite that we don't do amputations of feet. Well, we do amputations all the time. We just don't go above the foot because that becomes the leg. That is out of our scope. I just ask this body to consider this because it kind of takes the loophole out of people that prevent people, the people of Oregon, who require our services. It makes them go through a long list of qualifications before they can ever enter into our office for treatment. Another example, and I'm just going to close with this, is because I'm really quite upset with the BME who has filed and will testify against us. We have fought in the past to be part of the BME with a voting privilege. The body has thought and told us that this is not important, that they look out for our interests, that they represent us. Well, here's a perfect example of a bill that we prepared long ago, which has been sitting on their desk for a long period of time. We are there and available to answer any questions they might have. But a certain executive director, who is born with prejudice as to what a physician is in her own mind and her own heart, has taken privilege to come and testify today. And she's doing this without meeting with her board. At no time did she ever call the two podiatrists that sit on this committee to find what their input was. I find that discriminatory and uncalled for and inexcusable. Now, we're not here to go and try to get on the board. We're just trying to do something that's right, not only for us as a profession, but for the people of Oregon. The people are the ones with foot problems. they're the ones that are harmed when they don't get quick attention. Ohio recently did many, many studies, and I just want to cite this one evidence here. Just with diabetes, in Ohio there were 39,718 diabetics on the Medicaid program. There were 1,430 amputations based upon research that shows 15% of diabetics will experience a foot ulcer, and with up to 24% requiring amputation. $25.8 million direct amputation and rehabilitation costs based on 1992 Medicare dollars to Ohio's Medicaid program for diabetic amputations alone, which is 10 times the proposed cost savings in their program. So we just need, the people need an access to us without going through the loops, and I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Any
questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott and Kathleen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. The board is empowered by the legislature to license, investigate, and discipline physicians, podiatric physicians, physician assistants, and acupuncturists. And the legislature has empowered the board to protect the people of the state of Oregon and not represent the individual profession's interests. The board opposes House Bill 2692, which proposes to change the definition of physician to include podiatrist. The current law is careful to distinguish between the scope of practice of medical doctors and that of podiatrists. Medical doctors and osteopathic physicians are educated and trained to diagnose and treat physical and mental conditions, whereas podiatric physicians and surgeons, they are limited to treating ailments of the human foot and ankle. In addition to podiatrists, the legislature has also designated other professionals to use the word physician as a part of their title. And some examples are chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, optometric physicians. Using this title with the qualifier helps to prevent any confusion for the public. And it differentiates between medical doctors, osteopathic physicians. For this reason, too, the board feels that it would be unwise to change the law and permit podiatric physicians to simply call themselves physicians. I did a little survey with other states and sent out an email and asked what other states were doing. And I received about a 50% response rate, and I could find one state in which podiatric physicians were simply called physicians, and that was in Oklahoma. In all the other states, the primary terms were podiatrist or podiatric physician. In addition, there are parts of the Medical Practices Act in which we talk about physicians as being able to supervise physician assistants, and it would need to be very clear that podiatric physicians are not in that capacity. The board does not have a problem with granting podiatrists the opportunity to dispense medications that fall within their scope of practice, that is, relative to ailments of the foot and ankle. But the board does feel that the passage of 2692 would cause more confusion than it would potentially solve, and asks your committee to consider these issues in its deliberations. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Scott first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, and I have given to the committee a fairly extensive analysis of the proposed bill, which was primarily done by our counsel.
But let me preface my comments with making an observation. Our comments in my testimony regarding the implications of the proposed bill before you does not indicate in any manner that I'm aware of the qualifications of podiatric physicians to do the particular specialty work that they do. The issue before the committee and that is presented in the bill itself is what kind of implications does a general change in all of the statutes where physician may be referenced, and there are hundreds of them in ORSs. I've been doing this business for about 20 years, over that, I hate to admit. Statutes that are referenced in the bill as being affected are only some of them. I asked my counsel particularly, have we been able to capture all of the statutes where a medical doctor or doctor of osteopathy might be referenced in a statute? And their clear response was no. So I essentially asked our counsel to evaluate the bill on what kind of impact it would have on other statutes. It has nothing to do with the practice that podiatrists currently have. And apparently, from the previous testimony, I am a little confused about the actual purpose of the proposed bill. I mean, it does sound like a scope of practice bill, even though it's also been characterized as merely attempting to change statutes and refer to podiatric physicians as physicians in all cases. So that is confusing in and of itself, and I'm sorry that the previous speakers are upset, but there are statutes, for example, that are being amended that really don't make much sense to amend. For example, one of the statutory references is for cooperative compacts between hospitals that have physicians involved in heart kidney transplants. It does not make much sense to me to reference podiatric physicians in that statute, since it is very unlikely, for example, that they would be involved in that particular sort of agreement between facilities and physicians, for obvious reasons. The issue of reimbursement, for example, there are ample statutes that address being able to contest a decision by an insurer, and I'm not saying that physicians are always happy with the decision an insurer may make, but as far as I know, there are current statutes that enable podiatrists, without changing the law, to contest decisions by insurers, and it's not necessary to change the language currently. There is also a statute currently on the books regarding hospital privileges for podiatric physicians. Again, the issue is there really a need to modify the statute regarding we passed in the 80s? The Medical Association was primary sponsor of that legislation under medical staff bylaws statutes in Oregon, where hospital governing boards and medical staffs determine the standards of care within facilities. The change of that statute may very well have implications on how the governance within those institutions and between hospital medical staffs are affected, which the committee should think about by the implication of the changes that this bill proposes. It is also true, as was mentioned, there is a statute regarding intractable pain management that would be affected by the change proposed in this bill, which again you need to think about seriously of whether or not it's appropriate for podiatric physicians to be included under that particular statute. My counsel also points out, and the testimony before you points out, that there are varying definitions of provider under Medicare regulations. Sometimes a provider references a facility, sometimes it references a physician, and it is not really the model that may have been implied in previous testimony. The fundamental issue, at least for us, is whether or not there are implications by the change that go beyond maybe the intent of the proponents of the bill that really have not been thought through in the long run, and what it may mean as a matter of policy, which is something that obviously the committee must consider. At one point, it was my understanding that the proponents were considering that the primary issue might be the ability to dispense medications for their patients for ailments related to the foot. Apparently, that is not the case, and we just think that the bill needs serious work and thought before it is given any consideration of being moved out of this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Representative Delco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gallant, is it the Oregon Medical Association's position that podiatrists would engage in the practice of treating intractable pain, or managing intractable pain?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, the issue is by changing the statutes generally. Does that then provide statutory authority under the law for a podiatrist to do that? That is a policy issue. It's also a technical legal issue, and it's a legislative statutory issue that is not answered and has not been answered by the proponents that I'm aware of. So it's not, you know, I have not said that is their intent, but the implication of the change may authorize that activity, which is a legitimate question to raise and address if, in fact, that's true. And that's all my counsel has done, and that's what my testimony presents to the committee, is that there are implications of changing a definition throughout the entire ORS that may have implications that you're not aware of, and you should be aware of them. I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I don't think I heard an answer to my question. Let me ask you this, Mr. Gallant.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, I cannot speak for the proponents of the bill of whether or not that was their intent or not their intent. Again, the issue is, does the change have that impact to enable that activity to occur? And if so, is that an appropriate policy?
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Gallant, is it the position of the Oregon Medical Association that podiatric physicians would be engaged in kidney transplants, as you testified?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, maybe I've not made myself clear. My task representing physicians and looking at the bill before you was to try to analyze what kind of impact the legislative change might have in regard to other statutes. The intent of making those changes and their implications fall, I think, first on the proponents' lap of whether or not they intended to make those changes and why. My charge, and I think an appropriate one, was to look at the proposal on its face, try to make an objective determination of whether or not it had implications in other statutes and potentially their scope of authority to practice, and our counsel advises me, and I'm advising you, that it does.
One final follow-up. What about the issue of the testimony raised by the podiatric physician that the reimbursement for the procedure isn't the same. I believe the example reference was bunion treatment. Is it the position of the Oregon Medical Association that podiatric physicians shouldn't receive the same level of payment for that particular service?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, I'm an old-fashioned person, and I believe that people who go to extensive training, sometimes into subspecialty training for years and years, who become experts in super subspecialties like, you know, pick one, pediatric neurosurgery, that in our environment or the way the U.S. works on compensating people for their skills, that there is justifiably a distinction between paying someone with particular skill sets than others. We see it all the time. Is it, you know, in this one particular instance or example appropriate? I can't answer that. But I do think that people are, in fact, reimbursed differently for different levels of skill, and I think that's appropriate. Otherwise, the issue is whether you know, we should pay everyone the same amount of money regardless of their level of skill, and maybe that's your position.
And so are you saying that individuals engaged in podiatric medicine for that specific treatment modality are less skilled than medical doctors engaged in a super subspecialty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, what I tried to say, and I apologize for not being clear, is that I do believe that there are differences in training and skill by different specialties in the practice of medicine, and they are paid differently, even within, you know, for medical doctors and doctors of osteopathy. I am not trying to disparage podiatric physicians. I'm sorry that there are payment differentials, but I do believe that people who are highly skilled should be paid at a higher rate than those who may be less skilled, and it's true in a lot of areas outside of the practice of medicine.
And on a separate note, Mr. Gallant.
I'm Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathleen, I want to know, you said that chiropractors can be called physicians and optometrists can be called physicians. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I said that they have the qualifier like podiatric physicians do. So chiropractors cannot be called physicians. Naturopaths cannot be called physicians alone. They can be called chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, in the same way that podiatrists are called podiatric physicians.
That's the only clarification I need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding this distinction correctly, so physician implies that somebody, a physician, has training and expertise to cover every...
A broad range of
problems in the human anatomy. And the qualifiers, we talk about a chiropractic physician or a naturopathic physician or an
optometrist,
et cetera, they have very specific, just a more limited range of abilities and expertise. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, it is, because there's a difference in the training and education. And so that's what the legislature, in your wisdom, has decided should be. There's a very different, big difference in the training. And it's different to say that you're a podiatric physician than to say that you've been certified by the American Board of Medical Specialties.
So, if I may follow up, so the qualifier is what is important to you. Is that what I'm
understanding? That's right. And
it's not the problem them you call physicians, but it's the qualifier that's important.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we feel that that gives the best information to the consumer, too.
Thank you.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gallant, I understand that the Medical Association prepared a pretty significant legal analysis of this bill. I'm just wondering, as the proponent of this bill, why haven't I received a copy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, you have it in front of you right now.
time, but it was prepared yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, Representative,
for me to review.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, it was prepared before today or yesterday. I apologize that I did not get that to you or the rest of the committee members sooner. Maybe this sounds like an excuse. We're following about 500 bills, Representative Dalto. This is one of many. It is clearly not the most significant bill or issue before this body. And you most certainly have my public apology for not receiving it earlier. Most certainly, if you had made an inquiry of whether I had an analysis of the bill, I most certainly would have provided it to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one question for Dr. Haley, if I might.
One, because we need to get cooking here.
Dr. Haley, has your board taken an official position on this bill? 692.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I'm not a physician.
Ms. Haley.
That's fine. The board met. We have a legislative committee, and they met, and the board met, and they decided that this change was not necessary in the statute. And yesterday I also called the chair of our legislative committee when I got word that there was going to be a hearing. And he, too, reaffirmed that the board would be opposing this, but that the board would be comfortable with having podiatrists be able to dispense medications. That kind of a modification the board would be comfortable with.
When did your board meet on House Bill 2692?
I don't have, Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I don't have the agenda before me, so I can get that information for you.
Was it last week? Was it last
week? No. The board meets on a quarterly basis. So they last met in January, and they meet again tomorrow for 2 days.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make one clarification before it looks like you're going to just very brief. There seemed to be an implication about the rural health tax credit that something devious had happened when that legislation was originally adopted. I happened to be one of the proponents of that legislation ages ago when it was passed. And by the way, it's been very effective, in case anyone wants to talk about rural health tax credits. And I have to admit that in representing MDs and DOs, we were most interested in retaining those practitioners in rural areas. And so I guess if I am to be faulted for the original legislation of anything, fault me for representing the members that I represent. And that's what we did.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on this. I want to give Representative Dalto and others a chance to make sure that there aren't unintended consequences here, and then we can bring it back when we have had a chance to do that. So I'm going to close the work session on, thank you very much, 2692. And I want to open a work session on, oh, no, I can't find my numbers, 3156, for the purpose of allowing these folks to give their testimony so they don't have to hang around all day.
2156.
3156. The restaurant bill. Y'all remember the restaurant bill?
That.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to bring to your attention that attached to your SMS, as well as the dash two amendment, the department, there was a question at our first hearing on the current fee, licensing fee for the food programs. The agency did provide us with that documentation. If you don't have it, let me know.
And just so you'll know, we are expecting one more amendment that is a minor change, which is one of the reasons we can't move it at this point in time. But speak to the amendments, the agreement, how everybody loves each other. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike McCallum from the Oregon Restaurant Association, and we have done a lot of work on this piece of legislation. It started out as a bill that essentially would have removed the county from the food program. What we've ended up with is a bill that frankly retains the local delivery authority, but does so under a much strengthened state oversight law. And I think the guts of this is an intergovernmental agreement that counties will have to sign with the department every year. And in that intergovernmental agreement, it will identify the exact roles and responsibilities of both the state and the county in implementing that this program. In addition, in setting that scope, annually it says that members from the industry, members from local health, and members from the department will have to reach consensus on exactly what the scope of that program is, and that consensus will get rolled into the IGA that's renewed annually. It also deals with fees in a couple of areas. It talks about how we're going to require that county fees be as similar as possible to the fees that are set in statute. And what it says is, as long as counties are in compliance with a cost formula that will be specified in the bill, they can deviate from the state fee up to 20%. Okay, if they go beyond that 20% deviance, they'll have to come back and be subject to an audit from the state as to why they can't complete this program within the scope of fees that the other entities are able to do so. In addition, we've taken the fees that are established in statute and we raised those about 5%. And that gives us the flexibility we think we need to have the majority of the counties, in fact, almost all the counties, will be in compliance under the statute as we exist now. So we won't be forcing any major amendments to fees that exist in the current counties today. We also talk about food service advisory committees, and we essentially remove the mandate that every county has to have one. But we will put into the IGA language that says counties should be encouraged to have one, and then allow that to be a focus for public input as well as industry input into the local implementation phase. And then finally, there is an amendment that will deal with the food handler program. It's a pretty minor one. It talks about the ability for fees to be charged each time an individual takes the course or the exam versus just the fee being able to be charged once, and that's a $10 fee. We did have discussion around whether it was appropriate or not to adjust that fee. We decided in these economic times it's not a time to start raising the fee on the food handler, so we've left it intact. I think that really talks to the amendments we've all agreed to. It has been an extensive work group from the state and local health officials as well as local health administrators. And I'm satisfied we've got a set of amendments that will move the food program forward.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, the administrator of Department of Human Services Office of Public Health Systems.
And I
used to be the health division.
Yeah. And first of all, I want to express tremendous respect and appreciation for all the parties who have been a part of this since before my arrival on the scene in February, and continuing on today and throughout the coming years, when it's going to truly be, I think, an improved, integrated, systemic change that will provide enhanced inspection and more importantly, enhanced protection of foodborne illness. That's particularly important for us within health services, and I think that we have worked long and hard and in tremendous good faith with all the parties. And I want that to be reflected in the record. We would not be sitting here today if it were not for the good works of everybody. on behalf of the department is an important phrase as well, because this truly is a statewide responsibility. This is a statewide system, and it consists of two components, with the strong state oversight that we identify, clarify, and repeat throughout this process, and then also in the bill, and then delivered locally as part of an integrated public and environmental health system at the local level, with the flexibility and the responsibility at the local level to determine how best to make sure that that this program works on the ground in counties and communities around the state. We are, our department is convinced that the changes that we expect to be seeing from Legislative Council to House Bill 3156 reflect the principles that all along we have said are most important to us, to have that sort of integrated, strong, consistent, reliable, and solvent foodborne illness protection program. We do expect that as a result of this change, clearly our work within the department will be changing, and there may well be adjustments necessary in other funds limitations. This has no impact in terms of a general fund. I know that my boss, Barry Cast, the assistant director for health services at DHS, has made that clear both internally within our department as well as to Ways and Means Subcommittee Chair Winters. Who clearly has a personal as well as professional interest in making sure that this program works. So I did want to draw the committee's attention to that. So I'm very, very pleased to be here today, and I look forward to continuing to work with all the parties, as I said, to make sure that this program works on the ground. I don't know if, Sandy, you want to or want me to read into the record this. Linda Fleming, who is the executive director of the Conference of Local Health Officials, is not yet here in Salem. Coming from the proud community of Fossil, takes a little bit longer than zipping up or down I-5. And
we've got it for the record.
Great. So she has been a very important part of this process, and I think you will see her later today. Perhaps as well, if you want to question her personally about her positions on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for all the hard work, and I'm assuming with the nod ahead that counties are.
I better come out and explain to you right now, Chair.
I knew I shouldn't have.
I'll be quick. Gordon Pultz, Association of Oregon Counties. We have no position on the bill. That's only because we had not received the dash twos and or the new adjustments that are made today in time for our legislative committee on Monday. We do intend to look those over this afternoon, however, and all counties are alerted to what this is. The most important part for us was trying to preserve the integrity of local fee setting, which this bill does. Obviously, it does give a range, but the range only triggers an audit, and I think we can probably live with that particular provision. So we're looking forward to at least being neutral on the bill, if not supportive, as we look through this.
Okay. One would assume, Gordon, that although you haven't seen the amendments, you know what they're supposed to do, right?
I know what they're supposed to do, Mr. Chair,
and given
the fact that they do what they're supposed to do and the new revisions that were made today do what they're supposed to do, we should be okay.
Okay, and God willing, Elsie will have it exactly the way it's supposed to be. So,
God willing.
you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you all very much, and you don't have to come back. Okay. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3156, and we will recess until 5.
Do I have to come back? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.